This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 409 for February 16 of 2018. NAIS, NASCAR, and NHTSA numbers hit the skids. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
All right, another episode of Out of Line After Hours. Mr. Gary Vasilash, how are you, sir?
I am well this week. Last week, I was at home watching the show, as I'm sure many people are right now. And I got to say that that Don Runkle show was a really good show.
Well, you were under the weather.
I had acute bronchitis, and it was nasty. But, you know, and it was interesting, you know, for those who didn't see the show, I mean, I honestly think that people should go back and look at that, because I think that Runkle is, like, one of the last of a breed of somebody who had been in this industry for a very long time, grew up analog, has sort of gone digital. And so, you know, and we're not going to have those people anymore. I mean, so he was a real car guy, right, mm-hmm. who worked at General Motors, and he went to a supplier. Then now he's on the board of many advanced technology companies. And we're not going to see that. I think that's again, the breed is going away.
Yeah.
So great show.
Yeah, it was a great show. And we're going to have another great show here because we've got Stephanie Brinley from IHS Market with us here today. Great having you, Steph.
Thanks for having me back.
And Joe White from Reuters. Great to have you here, too,
great
Joe.
To be here.
Yeah, no, it's and we got a whole list of things to talk about that you've all contributed to. But I'll just kick it off and we'll see where this whole conversation goes. Mercedes-Benz dropped a bomb on Detroit in the last mm-hmm. week saying, you know what, we're not coming back to your car show next year. And maybe we'll be back in 2020. And what do you guys think? I mean, is this the beginning of the end of the Detroit Auto Show as we've known it?
I think that it's not necessarily the beginning of the Detroit Auto Show, but it's further proof that automakers have a huge plethora of platforms with which to deliver their news and with which to communicate, and they're taking advantage of that. There's some interesting elements of that as well. I think Mercedes is like some of the other Germans. The North American sales arms that they have will make the decisions for the regional shows, which would be New York, Chicago, and L.A., where Stuttgart or their home office makes the decision for Detroit because it's the OICA International Certified Show. So it's not necessarily even a decision about Detroit versus L.A. or Detroit versus CES for the body that's making the decision. It's about Detroit versus Paris versus Beijing yeah. versus whatever.
Shanghai.
It's Shanghai, or do we go someplace else altogether?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on. I agree
with all of that, and I think you're seeing more and more, I mean, including the Detroit car companies. You know, the Detroit car companies went, even though the Silverado and the Ram truck were big reveals and highly important products, I mean, they were kind of done off-site in a way. And you know, I was reading Automotive News was saying that Ford has a new focus for Europe, which is a big deal for Europe. But they're going to show that in April at an event that apparently that they're going to host, right, and not at the Geneva Auto Show. And the thing, right, I mean, the auto companies have figured out they can have their own auto show, just an auto show of one. Don't have to fight the fight to get attention. They'll get plenty of media coverage via the World Wide Web and all other means. We'll all go dutifully write about it if it's a major enough product.
One of the interesting things for that, too, if you're talking about bringing media to an off-site event like that, you know, your schedule, all of our schedules, gets really full. You know, there's a point where you, as a media person, can't travel as much to do it. So you're relying on not necessarily having been there in person and not necessarily having seen it in person. Another one doing the same thing is Volkswagen is introducing the Touareg at an event in Beijing on, I believe, the later part of March, where they're skipping Geneva, they're skipping New York, and they're skipping the Beijing show. Not necessarily not being present in those shows, but not using any of those three platforms to introduce the Touareg, which also I found really quite interesting
yeah.
as well.
No, that's
but
right.
The Mercedes thing, I mean, it seems to me it's more than just media introductions. I mean, people don't care about that. I mean, let's face it. The thing that I wonder about is that Dieter Zetsche lived in this town for,
yes,
what, 5 years?
Yeah.
And he was a big supporter of Detroit mm-hmm. when Detroit needed big support. I mean, the city, not just the auto show. And the thing that I got to wonder, I mean, so Stephanie, to your point, I mean, if these decisions are being made, you know, not locally, but they're being made, you know, in Stuttgart, not in Atlanta.
Right.
I mean, doesn't Dieter realize the implications of this for the city of Detroit, this represents?
Well, no doubt. And by the way, I mean, I was in Stuttgart recently, I think Daimler and Mercedes, and Dieter Zetsche personally, their interest in, love for, and concern about the American market is undiminished. I mean, it's still highly important to them. But I think Stephanie's right. I mean, I think these companies it gets down to dollars and cents. And the competition for, a certain pot of marketing dollars, which is under even more pressure, as is everything, because they've got to spend all this money on electrification and a million other things. I just think they look at these auto shows, and especially the German companies, the luxury, because a couple of the luxury brands were not present in Detroit this year. And I think especially the German luxury brands are looking at Detroit as increasingly more of a regional show, kind of back to what it was pre, 1989.
Yeah. Right. And, only reason they...
And they don't sell here. Right. They don't sell.
The other part of that
Detroit's
whole thing.
Not the biggest market, no. But they were always here anyway. And in fact, a bunch of others used to be here, Maserati, Ferrari, Lamborghini, right. and the like, and they've slowly dropped out over time. But the reason they were here in the first place was Detroit, to your point, Stephanie, was an international show, is an international show.
I think it still is. It's not done yet.
But it used to get all kinds of international media, and they're not showing up.
Well, and here's the thing. So Mercedes, to my knowledge, I know Mercedes was at CES.
Yes.
And I have not heard that they have dumped CES, although that's a whole different show. My feelings about CES.
It's not a fixed point on the calendar for any automaker to be there every year.
No, but I think when they have something to say, and Mercedes might well come back when they have something to say. Maybe they figure, okay, we've got products, but
will there be a show to come back to?
Well, the reason I'm asking this is because BMW
and Audi are going to say,
oh, of course,
Mercedes is not here. What are we doing?
Well,
there?
Audi's already downsized their show in a way that every journalist can recognize, which is there was no more dining room, no more lunch, no more white sausage,
no press conference,
and no press conference. So, I do think the auto shows as a venue have, and I'm sure glad I don't run one because I don't know the answer to what they do, but they've got to rethink how are we relevant. How are we relevant as an event, or is it just like a fair where people come in and
a shopping fair?
And if that's what it is, then Mercedes probably doesn't need to be, or Porsche doesn't need to be in Detroit. They're going to, however many vehicles they're going to sell in the Detroit market, they're going to sell whether they're at the show or not.
So is the question, how are they going to be relevant, the right question, or is it simply, are they relevant?
No, I think it's still how. And there's still two parts of the show. I mean, the media introduction side is what we interface with much more, and that's where we're seeing the value. The other half of that, of course, is selling cars. It happens in the next week after, and Detroit's not a terrific market for some of these automakers. One of the interesting things, if you look at Maserati and Ferrari and Rolls-Royce pulling their stands off the floor, they're still participating in the gallery on Saturday night where they actually sell vehicles. So if you can sell vehicles, you're still in there.
So for people that don't know, this is an area that was set up where they had a variety of singular cars from these makers. They didn't have a booth per se.
They
it was
invite
just like an area.
It's a really very restricted event. They invite people who are more likely to actually buy the car. And the owners that they invite get excited because they've got high level executives interfacing with them as they look at the car.
Especially in that sort of the high end of the luxury market, that's of way more value, right? Than just having a couple of cars and a model. A human model out there, for a week and a half with 99% of the people walking by are never going to buy this vehicle ever. There's just no chance, not going to happen, as opposed to, cultivating, the cult in that way.
Well, Detroit has also lost Mazda, and they've lost Volvo, and they've lost Jaguar Land Rover. We mentioned Porsche. But, I mean, you see, look at, like, Mazda, mass market brand. I mean, wouldn't this be appropriate for them to be here?
We also lost Nissan, and Nissan came back. I'm not sure that it's a done deal that Mazda will never come back again. They're, capital constrained a little bit as well. But I think, Joe, you hit on something in terms of the opportunities that we have and in terms of the capital issues and the things that they're funding. If we go to a point where the sort of futurist assumption is that no one even wants to own a car and you just want to be able to call somebody up or talk somebody on a phone, have them pick you up, drop you off, then the communication that you need to have with a consumer is fundamentally different. And we don't really know how that's going to shape out. So that's going to impact how people make decisions about auto shows, even in the near term, even though we're not even near really seeing that change in car ownership happen on a deep level. But we're going to see, I think we're going to see a lot of freneticness and a lot of really strange decisions, or strange compared to our traditions, decisions. And we're going to see a lot of automakers choosing and trying, testing a lot of different things.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And so, and each of those tests costs money.
Yep.
And they sit there, you know, Ford, for instance, a couple weeks ago, where, you know, Jim Farley's talking about, well, we're going to take $200 million out of our marketing budget because, you know, they've got their issues at Ford. Well, I don't have no idea where he's going to find that $200 million, but I wouldn't be surprised if auto show participation was a line item somewhere on that, in that debate, right?
Yeah.
You know?
And if you're Johann Denischen and you're sitting there, you're saying, Mercedes is pulling out of Detroit. Do I want to be in Detroit?
Well, he probably does, with Cadillac. You know.
Does he?
Well,
if you go back
to
sales,
doesn't have something to
Detroit
say,
is a good market for Cadillac. So, yeah, you do still want to be here.
Okay, we got Joe Laszlo wrote in to say the national non-automotive coverage of this year's NAS was non-existent. He says L.A., CES, and New York are the three big shows for exposure.
I thought NBC had a thing on a Saturday afternoon when I was going through channels. And it was
I'm sure there was some national coverage. I know the car and truck and utility of the year got coverage and the like. But I think he's right. CES got mega national coverage, a lot of automotive stuff. And if you're in L.A. or New York, guess what? Two biggest media markets in this country. So they're just naturally going to get more coverage.
Yeah, I mean, I think also...
I haven't seen the final numbers yet, but up until now, it's never been true that L.A. or New York got more media coverage.
Yeah. I think, though, this...
Good point.
I don't know why it was suddenly true this year.
But what about non-automotive media coverage?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I think this year's Detroit Auto Show
more non-automotive media coverage. It's about technology.
Well, true.
This year's Detroit Auto Show, though, I mean, again, and I know this is reductionist and narrow, but this year's Detroit Auto Show is basically about two big trucks.
Yeah.
Well,
and one
mid-size that will be coming.
Right. See, I, you know, okay, fine. But it was about two big trucks.
Yeah. Right.
And I think from the point of view of outside the Iron Triangle here, that this was a tough show because there wasn't stuff that a lot of people. I mean, now having said that, you know, the Ram and the Silverado, and for that matter, the Ranger together, are going to outsell 20 other brands to, you know,
Absolutely.
Put together. So.
In terms of volume, you're a million and a half in three cars.
But it was a truck show.
It was a truck show.
Even Mercedes came here because I think they wanted to introduce the new G-Wagon.
Where else but?
Well, you know, if you do it in Europe, all the media is going to be, why are you introducing an SUV? Don't you know they pollute? Whereas you go to Detroit, people go, wow, that's cool.
That's great. How much does it pollute? No. No, right. I think that's right. And so, look, I mean, I don't know what I wish I knew. Well, that's not true. I kind of have some ideas. Over the next couple of years, Mercedes has been pretty plain that they're going to be talking a lot about electric vehicles.
Right.
I don't think Detroit
is the place
exactly where you do that. There are other towns where you might want to make that, bring that message and have more luck with it than you would here for the time being.
The important thing is that there is a huge amount of choice that we didn't have 15 years ago even. Or even five, in terms of where to have the conversation and the World Wide Web we talked about earlier. I mean, the information flows very, very quickly for those who want to hear it.
Right.
So it's much less. The whole dynamic has changed, and it's not like we've talked CES versus Detroit. Right. It's not that. It's how do we leverage these properties in a different way? And it'll be interesting to see some of these pullouts. If in the long run they end up coming back. Maybe it ends up being a little bit more regional. But if they see an impact on sales, because I've been on the show before and we've talked to people who have data that show that the people who do go to the auto shows are actually looking to buy cars.
No question about it. They're shopping, and you
don't necessarily want to walk away from that entirely. So the question is, how do you manage it in limited budgets where you're trying to support EV, traditional ICE, because that's not going away soon, autonomous vehicle stuff, because that's coming, but... I mean, our forecast is still 75% of cars sold in 2040 will be traditionally driven. Only 25% autonomous vehicles globally in 2040. Yeah. It's a big number, but it's not everything. So there's a lot a lot of voices pulling at that point.
Well, Stephanie, so IHS came out with, and you probably wrote it, the study of what's going to be coming out in 2018, and you guys say 75
new vehicles or new body styles,
right?
And that, and it was a higher number, but relative to auto shows in 2018, a lot of those were introduced at auto shows in 2017,
mm-hmm.
just because of
so it'll be things just coming out naturally without having to tie it to a particular show,
right? I mean, or they would have been introduced in 17 and on sale in 18. So I was looking at market launches relative to you. Then you're looking at a more competitive space. You're looking at a market that's down from 17. We'll be down a little bit from in 18, and more models and more new cars and less money. And how do you then sell in that space? And how do automakers manage to still stay off the incentive train and break through? As much as it's great that we have all these platforms, it also makes it harder to find a consumer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We've beat the auto show discussion to death. Time for a great segue. I think we've got a phone call that will launch us off in another direction because it gets into a topic you wanted to bring up, Gary. Carmen, let's bring that phone call in.
Hello, this is Clem Zarofsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, how long do you think the big three are going to, actually not the big three, but how long do you think the automobile manufacturers are going to support NASCAR? My first NASCAR race was Darlington, 1955, and I with through the years I went to the races, the stands were full. Now there's nobody there. There's nobody even there the other night for the shootout, which used to be almost a sellout. So how long can the automobile manufacturers afford to support this? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Clem. Thanks for being such a loyal viewer, too, by the way, because I recognize the voice and the name. But, Gary, you want to bring up NASCAR?
I was going to look at my watch when he asked that question. It'll be about that long. We were talking about this a little bit before the show, and so looking at numbers, so I looked at the ratings for the Homestead race last year. That's the
last race,
the last
of
race,
the season where they determine the championship.
Right. So the NASCAR series finale. So the viewers, it was down 20% in ratings and 23% in viewership from the last year, and down 36% and 39% from 2015. So basically the viewership of what, so I would say that it's like basically Daytona and then Homestead, right? The first race of the year where, you know, it's all exciting and everybody wants to see it, and then the last race of the year to see who's going to be the champion.
And even that's down.
And if that's down, I don't think the issue is how long the automakers will support it. I think the real issue is how long the advertisers will support it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you look at many of those cars now, I mean, we used to see all name brands on cars. And now you see, like, you know, mattress companies. I mean, it's just like it's not
appropriately enough.
You know, but it's not tied. I mean, it's something very bizarre. And so I think that's the real thing. I mean, it's just like, how long will teams get money from sponsors that will keep them being able to drive?
And how long does, I mean, NASCAR, I mean, so I am, first of all, let me just say, I am not a NASCAR fan, so, and I dip into racing.
You're not anti-NASCAR.
You're a NASCAR super fan. Come on, admit it.
No, I'm not. And so, you know, the people who are NASCAR fans can judge what I'm about to say accordingly. But from what I can tell, number one, over the last several years, NASCAR has been trying to kind of continually level the playing field, right? You know, get all the teams, you know, the same. And number two, and this has been going on for a long time, I mean, it's a really long time since these have actually been stock cars, right? They're not cars you can buy. They're these supercars that are made and handmade and all this stuff. So the relevance to the automotive brand, to me, has been a mystery for quite a while. And then, you know, the organizers of NASCAR have a moral duty and obligation to make this safe, right? So I get that, and that's the highest priority. Having said that, I think in so doing, they created an event that's kind of dull.
Yeah.
I mean, so what do they do? I mean, you know, you go back and you have, you know, like go back to actual stock cars and like put whiskey barrels in the back and it'll go crazy. If you could do it safely, I don't know, maybe you have like, you know, everybody hack, you know, instead of saying nobody can cheat, everybody's going to have the same engine, to go the complete opposite way, which is what it used to be in the beginning, right? It's like, who can hack the engine? Who can, you know, who can do this?
Who can cheat the best?
I mean, any of that would be more fun if you could do it safely than what they seem to have on the road right now.
The Junior Johnson series.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it's to what the point that you raised, Steph, about car shows. The whole nature of media has changed so much. And now nobody's willing to sit down for 36 Sundays in a year and watch a 4 to 5 hour television broadcast of cars going around.
Some of them go on road courses.
Yeah. And, you know, you know, what NASCAR's arguing is, oh, online streaming is coming up, but I don't think it's coming anywhere near to the audience they lost on television. And again, they got to figure out a way to make themselves more relevant, and they haven't figured out how to do that. And so as the boomers disappear into the greater good of things, there's not a younger generation there to replace it from an audience standpoint.
Well, and part of it, I think, is the way that younger people are consuming anything is in bite-sized chunks. I mean, NFL is having problems. I mean, name a sports area, baseball, that's not having problems with losing audiences right now. It's not just NASCAR. It's not just football. It's baseball. It's, you know, the other racing series. Or even Formula E is not really taking off the way that people, that the organizers would have liked it to.
I've
it's a
tried.
Little bit slow.
I can't. I've watched races.
I was thinking about, so Nissan just announced this week that they're going to go into Formula E, right? Okay. So Audi's in Formula E. Now Nissan will be in Formula E.
A bunch of them. But I mean, Jaguar.
Okay. So yeah, and I mean, so I was beginning to think maybe they've got something here. Maybe this is what, you know, because it's more like a video game than it's like, you know, backwoods racing. I mean, these guys are just like, okay, we're non-apologetic about this thing.
Right.
We're going to say we're going to have these electric cars, and we're going to have the fans be able to clap and give people a power boost. And it's not quite like that, but essentially that's what it is.
And you're joking. Why not? But why not? I mean, that's the kind of thing. The interactive, something that's interactive with the fans would probably work better. Something that I don't know. I mean, like I said, sort of the idea that you have like competitive hacking of the technology, just something that kind of gets people engaged and rooting would be more fun, I think. Again, I mean, I say this as someone who doesn't. I mean, look, I don't spend my time I once lived next to a guy in Florida who listened to NASCAR on his radio. Now think about that for a second.
On AM.
And it's like, okay, I guess, but it just didn't really resonate with me at all.
Okay, Wright Knight wrote in to say, put some roll cages and bigger brakes in some Mustangs, Camaros, and Challengers and make stock car have meaning again. Comes to your
I guess I'm with him.
It's sort of like IROC races of days gone by.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, I am a motor racing fan, and I've gotten very bored with NASCAR. But if I look at the sports car endurance stuff, I watched, I don't know how many hours of the 24 hours of Daytona. I don't know how many hours I'll watch of the 12 hours of Sebring and the 24 hours of Le Mans. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to do this every single Sunday, but there's multiple categories. The cars are, except for the prototypes, are honest-to-God street production cars that have been modified for racing. There's a lot of manufacturer support. In the three categories that are in this racing in the U.S. right now, there's essentially three different races going on. It's not as interrupted by – here's a picture. I mean, just to give you an idea of the field at the 24 hours at Daytona, there was like, I don't know, what, 36, 40 cars running, something like that. Lots of stuff, all these things going on. Because it's not that popular, they don't have as many commercials, so it's not interrupted as much.
Well, in this point, there's more strategy, in terms of how to win.
There is,
right?
But I find it amazing that I get so bored watching NASCAR for 4 hours, but I can watch the sports car racing for 6, 7, 8 hours, and I'm not bored.
Okay, but here's the question, and this sort of goes back to the first topic of auto shows, and these things seem to be coincident. Is it a case whereby, a certain generation of people have these expectations that this is what car shows are like? There's a certain generation of people who, by God, you're gonna pull their dead cold hands off the television knob to change it from NASCAR. I mean, but they're going to go away. Mm-hmm. And the people who are going to be interested in going to car shows, they're going to go away. And what are you left with? I mean, you got, yeah, you'll have the occasional person who's going to watch a race, but, you know, are they going to be like, you know, the NASCAR fans of yore who were basically like, you know, throwing stuff at Jeff Gordon because they didn't think he was a real NASCAR racer? I mean, you know,
the passion seems to be.
I agree. I agree there. I think you're right. I think there is a connection between sort of the malaise around auto shows and the malaise around NASCAR.
It gets back more, I think, to what Stephanie brought up. It's the changing aspect of media and how you can get what you want, because NFL football is seeing its ratings go down.
Yeah.
I mean, even with all the controversy that's gone on of taking a knee during the national, you know, I would think people would just tune in to see if somebody's taking a knee or not.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's going down. And I think if you look at almost all sports on television, coverage is going down. We're going through a transformation here in media.
Well, yeah.
You've got to figure out who is watching, who is interested, and how to reach them and where they're going to consume it. And we may be seeing a change in what people are interested in.
And how much time they'll spend sitting.
I mean, I'm with John. The sports car racing is always my favorite to watch. I was at Daytona this year. It's quite neat. One of the things that I really like about, a little segue, about going to sports car races, too, is when you're there in person, you can go to different points in the track, and you're just seeing, I mean, you've got the little number to tell you who's, what place they are and what class or whatever, but you just watch these oddly mismatched cars, just see how one driver gets up and around the corner and, you know, is passing somebody. It's just fun for me to just see these drivers and engage with each other in a different way than some of the all the cars are the same, the NASCAR kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, okay, so you guys are going around in circles. Although Daytona this year, the leaders were kind of the leaders the entire race, and there was a little bit less drama going on. But it's a cool environment to see. But the problem is if we don't have people between, you know, 18 and 35 interested in that, or interested in football, or interested in, then if you want to sell a car through that, you've got to find another way to connect with them.
Mm-hmm.
And another way to get them interested in your brand, and another reason for them to think that your brand is more important than another, and that there's an emotional connection in that space. And
goes to the question, Gary, that you started with, which is how long do the car companies support this to the level that they have done? And I think it's, you know, again, I mean, these folks are pretty sophisticated. They can measure all of the things, the variables that Stephanie is putting forward. And if they come to the conclusion that, you know what, we are just wasting our money, we are not getting our target audience, you know, by advertising and supporting this team, they're going to quit.
Oh, well, you're saying Farley, you know, taking that big chunk out of his marketing budget. I mean, I've got to believe that a percentage of that goes to the support of the various
motorsports
activities in NASCAR. Right.
But so, part of the one sort of saving grace in this whole motorsports conversation, and the reason that they're being interested in Formula E and some other things, is it's not just about selling cars. It's also about what technology you can develop and proving that you can develop that technology and be successful with it. There's an element of research and development that is borne out. Yeah, that does not.
They couldn't
do it
at the Nürburgring by themselves without having to race against other guys.
Well,
Honda's
probably best known for this, but Honda, I mean, used racing very much core to its core to its development of their best engineers and core to R&D. So that makes sense to me. I mean, it always did when Honda did it. I think other companies are likewise. That's like almost a recruiting tool, right? And a talent development tool.
Right.
That all makes perfect sense to me. I guess sort of mass advertising against an event that the target audience isn't watching.
Okay, we got a comment and a question here from our audience. Arno Schmidt wrote in to say, don't forget the 24 hours of Nürburgring. Great races. He's right. Barry Rector has got a question for all of us. He wants to know, for a car enthusiast, which one American car show would you recommend they attend? Detroit, Chicago, New York, L.A.?
So I might betray some ignorance, but I would say L.A. I would say L.A. because I think the different companies, especially the non-Detroit companies, do bring a lot of stuff. And then there's also this whole sort of custom car area at L.A.
that's not
replicated, I think, at the other shows to quite the same degree.
You're onto something with that custom area that they have in L.A. It's a pretty big section.
A lot of eye candy.
A lot of eye candy there. I might actually, it's going to sound odd, I might actually say Chicago, because a lot of the introductions, I mean, at that point, if you're going to see vehicles, you're not going to the press conferences. It doesn't matter when it was introduced.
Right.
What you want to see is the sheet metal, and Chicago has a lot of sheet metal, and Chicago is set up to be a consumer show more than any of the others. Mm-hmm. And so you can not only see a lot of cars, you can see a lot of the same cars and the same different colors, and there's a lot of opportunity there as somebody just interested in buying or interested in looking at a car to go there.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
I'd say Autorama.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is the hot rod show.
Yeah. Yeah. Detroit.
Seriously.
Yeah. No,
I agree with that. I mean,
if
you want to see new cars.
That's fun.
I mean, every major city has basically a strip. So the Troy Motor Mall in Troy, Michigan.
It's an auto show every day.
You want to see those cars? You know, you can go from one dealer to the other. They're next door. Not a problem. You want to see crazy? You're a car enthusiast? Go to Autorama.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with that.
I wouldn't either.
Okay, good. This is a great time for me to sneak in here because we've got to take a quick break right now. Commercial message from our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. It's Out of Line After Hours mid-break time, and that's when we always bring Dr. Data up on the stage.
Okay.
Sure, take it.
All right, so we're gonna do something. We haven't done one of these for a very long time. There is data involved, but it's a multiple choice question that I want you guys to answer. So, Carmen, please bring up the. All right. So this is some research that the Uber Advanced Technology Group did. Okay, and they're basically saying, and they don't expect this would happen, but they're just using this as a use case, that in 2028 there will be 1 million self-driving trucks on the road. As a result of having 1 million self-driving trucks on the road, the number of truck drivers will increase, decrease, or stay the same. So, Stephanie, what do you think?
I think I saw something about this, and I said that it increases. Sorry.
This is Joe?
I might have heard that.
Yeah, okay. Well, so, yeah, it definitely has. It looks like a trick question. So I'm going to say they said increase. I'm going to say, one, I doubt that there will be that many trucks on the road, self-driving trucks on the road. And two, if there are, that somehow or another industry will contrive to decrease the number of drivers in some way.
All right, so your answer is decrease.
I guess it's decrease. Long way to get there, but it decreases.
So you say decrease. Yeah. Stephanie says increase because she read something. And John, what do you think?
I'm going to say stay the same.
You're going to say stay the same. That would seem to be somewhat reasonable. But the answer is increase.
Okay.
What's the justification?
Explain this.
All right, so... Okay, so now this is according to the Uber Advanced Technology Group. There are two problematic trends for trucking. One is the average age of truck drivers today is 49. Okay, and they're basically saying that these guys are going to be retiring out of the thing. Number two, they say that there's a problem of attracting truck drivers.
All true,
right?
Yep. Both true.
Okay, so what they're saying is that if there are 1 million self-driving trucks on the road, what this will mean is that these trucks will actually be doing the long haul point to point. But when you get to cities, that you will then need to have truck drivers. Now, one of the problems with attracting truck drivers to do the long haul thing is they're never at home, right?
Right.
So basically they're saying that by doing it this way, you'll attract more people because they'll be just going to work in the morning. So here's a thing that you're seeing: the self-driving trucks, the long haul jobs, and in the local haul jobs. And so basically, the other aspect is, you know, to get back to, I don't know if we were on the air or not, we were talking about, you know, the abandoned shopping malls,
right?
Because everybody's buying stuff online, right? So how does that stuff get to your house?
These guys. Yeah.
By these guys.
Well, so now that I can get behind that chart. That chart makes sense to me. Long haul would go down. Local haul would go up.
We're using the term truck driver too as sort of what we have in our head. But that self-driving near term, even within local, really what that job entails is not necessarily driving. It's getting the packages off and walking them into the building.
Right.
Yeah.
So the job,
right.
it's much more of an
attendant and a customer service rep, not a The other thing that I have no evidence to back this up, but it seems to me that one type of truck driving that could get automated fairly quickly is the driving that goes on within a port or within a warehouse complex, right? Or within a factory complex. I was touring a factory recently, and there was, you know, people driving trucks from one building or warehouse on one side of the complex to a building on the other side. You know, if that's milk run kind of stuff, you could probably automate, and maybe those jobs go away. But again, maybe what you have instead is a person kind of managing that
Well,
process.
What others have talked about, too, is if you have an autonomous truck, now the person who had been the driver can be doing other things.
Right.
So imagine, just as an example, a post office truck. Instead of driving the vehicle all around and sorting mail, they can let the car or the truck drive itself while they do all the sorting and preparing
right.
to do.
Right.
And then they've got, like, the mail that's delivered to this building. Somebody's got to walk in, open the door, put it down on a little table, go out again. So
right.
those jobs probably will not be eliminated. And, in fact, you'll probably make those people far more productive.
Yeah. Look, I mean, and again, you know, I hope I live long enough to be to see whether or not I'm right about this. But by 2028, you know, I just don't know if the society and the regulatory apparatus of the United States of America is going to be ready to have a completely human-free long-haul truck barreling down, you know, I-80.
It's kind of a trick because a million vehicles by 2028 could be all the port vehicles that we just talked about. I mean, however they counted that,
right.
I'm not really sure of.
I just think, you know, free-range autonomous trucks on the interstates of America with no human being inside is a little bit further away.
I'm beginning to think that this might be what we're going to see more of sooner than we're going to see the individual private car autonomous thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they're going to work this out, and whether this means that basically they're going to have dedicated lanes that these robot trucks are on, and maybe they're...
Well, that would require require too much investment into the interstate itself.
It'll come in stages, and I can tell you right now what the trucking guys are focused on are platooning of trucks. Still with drivers in them, probably two trucks, with the second one following the one in front electronically.
Right, but they're saving
but
fuel
that way.
Now
the guy in back can sleep for 8 hours.
Right.
And now his truck moves
and
to the front, and
the
guy now it goes to the back, and he sleeps for 8 hours.
Right.
So now you don't park your trucks overnight. They go right across the country.
So that is completely rational and seems to be within the realm of technological capability.
I think that'll happen fairly quick.
But someone's got to go to Washington and convince either regulatory agencies of the United States government and or Congress that having, you know, doing what you just said is okay. Because right now the rules are that, you know, after 8 hours, the driver has to get off the road, or I think it's 8 hours or something like that.
It might
that.
Be 10 or
it
something.
It might be 10. But there's very recently imposed limits on how much drivers can be behind the wheel before they have to take an enforced break. Again, it's a safety imperative. It's something that should not be done away with lightly. But to get the economic benefit of the technology investment, that's what they're going to have to do. And so that's the next phase in all this.
There's some contradictory information a bit coming out of D.C. a little bit. I mean, Elaine Chao was in Detroit talking about how, you know, NHTSA and DOT are going to be really supportive of autonomous cars. And there was a hearing or there's some comments from a Democratic senator over the last 6 or 7 days saying, I don't know, we're moving too fast. Is this really? So we do still have that tension between the regulatory issues.
Yeah, there's a lot of fairly powerful interests that are not keen on autonomous anything, let alone, and certainly trucks. I mean, the Teamsters Union, for one, is very down on autonomous trucks for obvious reasons.
Right.
So,
all right, so before we leave the Dr. Data section of the show, I want to go. So 2 or 3 weeks ago, we did one about RVs and how the RV sales are exploding.
Yeah. Like half a million.
And I came upon this, that there's this guy who is basically starting this company called Outdoorsy. And this guy claims that more than 35 million people each year look to rent an RV, of which 38% are millennials. So this guy's basically going to start an Airbnb for RVs. So just,
that's
what, 35 million people a year looking to rent an RV?
It makes it, for
it's
millennials,
astonishing.
If the stereotype is true that millennials want more experiences than stuff, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and an RV, I mean, RVs are expensive.
They're expensive.
Yeah.
They're big time expensive. You get a nice one, it's easily you can spend $1 million on a really nice one, but you can, it's not a big,
you could, Joe.
Well, perhaps, but
that's our super fan.
In my bus. Yeah, but I mean, it's really not a big trick to spend $100,000 on an RV, and most people aren't going to do that. I just can't have the wherewithal and don't really want to. Where are you going to, park it? So that makes total sense. This guy's a genius.
Yeah. Okay, we've got a whole bunch of comments from our viewers right now. We got a phone call. Let's bring that one in first, Carmen.
Hey, John, it's Roger Blose calling from Fairfield, Connecticut. you're talking about the NASCAR and car shows. The Barrett Jackson auctions are the one place I go, and they have wonderful thrill rides with the manufacturers giving you rides in their top cars. It really makes a hit, and actually helped me to buy a new car recently. Thanks for the content.
Yeah, no, thanks for that call, and that's a great point. You know, you want to sell cars, put butts in seats.
Yeah, but it's interactive, right? I mean, you're interacting. You're giving the customer an experience. You know, as he said, an experience they maybe couldn't have any other way. And you know, that kind of thing clearly makes a difference. But you know, just kind of coming and staring at a static car, less so. You know, maybe.
Well,
not
and
so
we're
much.
Seeing more auto shows do that. It's just that we're not there on the public days, so we don't personally
right.
see it. But
yeah.
it is happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeep for instance at LA and other right. shows has the you know the thrill ride thing going on.
Toyota has
but
over at
when,
Chicago.
When Ford launched the Fiesta the last time, or was it the Focus? One of those two cars that basically what they did is they went across the country, and they set up in cities where they would give people. Rides and,
yeah.
and they made. I mean, they made an yeah, event about this
yeah,
thing.
I remember. Yeah,
I mean, they did one in downtown Plymouth, and
yeah,
and,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's right. And you know, again, I mean, I think. I mean, I guess to you know, if you've got a finite or fairly finite marketing budget, you know, do you put more money into these kind of interactive, you know, things? And I think the answer is yes.
Yes.
You know, and less money into kind of mass blast advertising.
And then it's a delicate balance, because when you stay away from the mass blast, if you stay away from the national advertising, you will lose sort of general awareness and relevancy. Because consumers, think of it this way. If you go to buy a car every 4 or 5 years or whatever, and you're not watching it, the industry all the time, you don't really know what you're looking for necessarily. I mean, some vague idea, but you know, you've got 40 brands to choose from. And 350 or 360 models
yeah.
to choose
yeah.
from. And obviously most of those are not going to be ones you're really considering. You know, every 5 or 6 or 7 years or whatever, my husband will say, it's time to buy a new television. I'm like, okay, great. Throw an information at me for a couple of days on the televisions and what. And I retain all of that for exactly as long as it takes for us
until you slap the credit card on the table at Best Buy
then I'm done.
Or at Amazon.
That is so true.
Yeah,
3 weeks later... I have no idea what size we bought.
Right. All the information is out of date anyway. You might as well forget it.
Yeah.
It's all out of date anyhow.
And I bought the thing, and it's in my living room, and it's done, you know, and we're using it, and it's fine. So I try to think about consumers when they're buying a little bit in that space. They're most often walking into something where they're not neck deep into it.
Did Joe go to a store and look at all these TVs and listen to the volume? Or did he basically go like, okay, I got the Consumer Reports TV and electronics issue, and this one's really rated. I think I'll go look at that one.
It's a combination.
Right.
I am married to a wonderful man who researches the heck out of everything. So, there's not a research source that he has not looked at before we go
right.
to this.
But even with and it's been a while since I bought a TV, but I remember that, I mean, and I'm not that obsessive about research on this, but I researched it, and then I still went to Best Buy, and I actually bought it at Best Buy, as most people do not anymore. But because you have to see it. And I think cars do still have that thing of like, I need to see how this car looks. I need to kind of see how I feel in it. And it's a big enough purchase that I kind of want to touch and feel it and make sure that the interior is laid out in a way that I find comfortable and that I don't feel like I'm sitting in a tub and all this other stuff. So cars definitely still have that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's still, and maybe it speaks to auto shows and also dealerships remaining relevant because look, even professionals in the auto industry can't judge a car unless they see it standing in real life under natural light, right?
Right.
That's why they still have clay models. They still
right.
do this. You know, it's like, you know, it's a woolly mammoth. Whereas, you know, 20,000 years ago, we haven't advanced. We still need to see the mammoth
right.
before we take it down. So I think there's a lot to that. You know, there's only so much you can do online.
But
and,
did you look at 40 cars, or did you say, no, I'm going to
No, I narrowed my
few, narrowed
and
down.
You probably did, you know, in your example.
Yeah, we narrowed down or whatever. But and that's certainly true, but that also speaks to the fact that if you step too far away from the national spotlight, whether it's national advertising, whether it's, you know, dealership stuff, whether it's auto shows, however you make sure that people are aware that your brand exists and what your brand can give them, then you won't be selected. You know, if you don't know how many brands are out there, you tend to get the first couple that you come across, and you know, you just kind of move on from there. So that balance is really, really difficult between finding the consumer that would be predisposed to your brand's values and making sure that other consumers are just aware that you even exist. At the time that they're thinking, I mean, it's tricky because you got to do it when they're thinking about buying a car, too.
And I saw a car ad on TV the other morning for $79, get a Silverado lease. It's like, damn.
$79?
Yeah, I don't even like Silverados. I'd go get one for $79. Yeah. And I'm not even interested in getting a truck right now. Right. But damn, $79.
But why not?
You know, right. I mean, it's just
right. At that price, exactly right.
Right.
Okay, look, we got to take another quick commercial break right now and give a shout out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're talking all kinds of things automotive here at Autoline After Hours. I just want to squeeze in a comment from Thomas Pollock, who wrote in to say, Elon's stunning success in space continued this week with the perfect launch of the Falcon Heavy. Contrast this to Tesla's ongoing struggle to launch the Model 3. Is designing and building a modern automobile actually more difficult than real rocket science?
Yes. Yes. Well, evidently. I mean, our listener, our viewer put it fairly well.
Yeah.
It's really complicated.
It's very good. And here's the difference. You know, when you're doing a rocket or something like that, it's a one-off, right? Yep. You put the thing together, you run these we have to delay the launch, and we're going to redo this. And you redo it. You only have to do one.
Right.
Now you want to start cranking them out, 5,000 a week, 10,000 a week, yowza.
Yeah, look.
Totally
I mean,
different
ballgame. Let's not minimize the achievement of SpaceX in having a reusable rocket and all the stuff they're doing. I'm not minimizing that. But, yeah, doing it and doing 5,000 a week of the same and making all however many hundreds of suppliers you've got orchestrate, come in and get the stuff there on time, yeah, it's really complicated.
Yeah. Gary, what else did you want to get
all right, this may engender some conversation, but this is a fun fact from Automotive News, not from me. So today, for those of you who are watching it live, is February 15th, right?
Mm-hmm.
So according to Automotive News, on February 15th, 2002, the last Prowler was produced by Daimler Chrysler in Detroit. So for those who remember, that was an aluminum-intensive vehicle that first appeared at the 1993 Detroit Auto Show. So you got auto show, got aluminum, you got... So, I mean, it's sort of interesting. So there you have a product that probably wouldn't exist had it not been for an auto show.
Could well be. And you got to say, it would never have existed if you didn't have the management then of Chrysler that you had.
Yeah. Well, and a management... Yeah, exactly. And people like Bob Lutz and who...
Tom Gale.
Yeah, and Tom mm-hmm. Gale, who at the time sort of said, look, how are we going to get this company back on its feet after I think they had done one of their periodic, double gainers. And well, the answer was, you know, we're going to have some fun.
And, you know, that's one of the things when we talk about auto shows is concept cars now are much closer to production intent than ever. I mean, we haven't seen a concept car like the Prowler.
Yeah. Right.
They're not
concept-y. Or even if you go with something that's an autonomous car concept, so it's a little bit techie, still kind of pretty much just a box shape. Mm-hmm. I mean, and Mercedes had an autonomous concept car a couple of years ago that was pretty exciting to look at with the interior special.
Yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
one of their visions. And even at this year's Detroit show, the Infiniti concept was quite beautiful. But still, we don't push the boundaries with concept cars like we used to, and that comes back to cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no budgets to do that.
It's just expensive. Too expensive.
If you want real rollers, i.e. Yeah, vehicles expensive. That could be driven, even if it's at 5 miles an hour, that adds a massive amount of cost than to doing, just say, like a fiberglass buck.
Right. So that can, you know, sort of impact your interest in auto shows.
But the thing of it is, again, I mean, you know, if some car company wanted to find out what people would think if they did, you know, I don't know what, you know, a station wagon with six wheels, all they would have to do is create an image of this thing and get Autoblog or one of the other Jalopnik or whoever to publish it, or Car and Driver, and they'd get their feedback and it'd all be fine. And they wouldn't even have to build a real model. They could just create a digital mock-up of this thing and put it out there. How do people like that? So, I mean, that even the market test aspect of it could be done less expensively.
It can be.
Yeah.
And it is being done.
It is being, right? Yeah.
So, Stephanie, one of the things that you wanted to talk about was the possibility of changing of the CAFE regulations that Bloomberg came out and did.
Yeah, we've had some conversation on that lately.
So, give us a background here.
So it was Bloomberg that reported on a NHTSA draft that they had seen. NHTSA is supposed to be presenting a draft, an analysis of a proposal by March 30th. Because I think they're supposed to close it out by the end of April 18, what the next thing is going to be. And one of the news outlets got a hold of the draft, and so they've made a lot of presumptions on what may or may not happen. The draft of the document that they saw, from the way that it was reported, is that it was just a series of possible proposals in there. And there were just some interesting things. One that was in there is about maybe we should make cars bigger and heavier because then they'll be safer. Which I thought really kind of a head scratcher. Not necessarily completely incorrect, but kind of a weird way to go around.
That's a BS way.
I was like, wow, that's kind of. Well, it was actually.
The current rules encourage bigger. They don't encourage heavier.
They do encourage bigger.
And yeah, I mean.
But this one's not heavier.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You were going to say more.
But what the point of that was if you pull back on your MPGs, then people will make heavier cars because they won't be worrying about it being lightweighted, and we can stop this like increase in deaths on highways. Some other things have been brought up as potential solutions there. But you know, it's one of those things where a draft document got out. It's not even finished yet. So it's a little early.
It was pretty
vague. So according to the story from our colleagues Ryan Bean, who used to work at Automotive News, and John Lippert, whom we used to be in Detroit, they say this is a quote. For example, one scenario in the draft NHTSA analysis would permit an average fleet-wide fuel economy standard of 35.7 miles per gallon by 2026, down from a 46.6 miles per gallon under the Obama-era target. Traffic fatalities would be reduced by an average of nearly 12,000 per year from 2036 to 2045, according to the analysis. So basically they're saying heavier cars.
Take that analysis with a grain of salt.
Go ahead. Keep going.
So,
yeah.
So I went to IIHS, and I looked, and I came with these following things that we need to outlaw in order to save lives. And this is from IIHS. I am not making this stuff up. I'm serious. Okay. So my first recommendation is don't drive in Mississippi. Okay. Okay. So according to IIHS, that in 2016 there were 34,439 fatal motor vehicle crashes in the United States. This results in 11.6 deaths per 100,000 people. Okay, 11.6 per 100,000 people nationally. In Mississippi, 23.1 deaths per 100,000 people, the highest in the nation. Tip two: outlaw SUVs in Wyoming and cars in Massachusetts, and motorcycles in the District of Columbia, okay? Because Wyoming had one of the highest percentage of deaths involved occupants of SUVs and pickups, 44%. Massachusetts had one of the highest proportions of car occupant deaths, 43%. And District of Columbia had the highest percentage of motorcycle deaths, 22%. I mean, I'm not making fun of people dying, by the way.
There's a preponderance of, I mean, Massachusetts people drive cars, and Wyoming they drive trucks and SUVs.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Don't drive alone in Montana, New Hampshire, or Vermont.
Words to live by.
Okay. Yeah. Nationwide, 55% of motor vehicle crash deaths in 2016 occurred in single vehicle crashes. The largest proportions of deaths in single vehicle crashes occurred in Montana, New Hampshire, and Vermont, 73% each.
But I like your comment about don't drive alone in whatever states. Yeah. That's like the old Benny Hill line. He said, you know, the chances of you getting on an airplane with somebody carrying a bomb is 1,000,000 to 1. He says, so I always bring my own bomb.
Right. Well, but so first of all, so there's two things I want to just on that quickly. I mean, let's not forget that 90%+ of accidents are caused by bad driver
error.
Behavior of error or whatever, you know, drunkenness or whatever. So that's the real sort of bottom line on safety is like, let's change behavior. So On the cafe or in the fuel economy thing, it is interesting. I mean, I saw this story too, and you know we've had at Reuters we've had our own reporting on this, which basically goes to, I think, roughly the same point, which is I think the Trump administration's instincts are to kind of ease up on the fuel economy rules, and it's the auto company's instincts to ask for a certain amount of relief. But right. At the same time, the problem is that California has a vote. And California is committed to reducing carbon dioxide emissions, in a pretty serious way. And I don't know what they're ultimately. I wish I did, but they're not what they're ultimately agree to. But I don't think California is going to agree to a radical rollback, 20-30% rollback in the standard. Because if that happens, I think California is going to walk and take several other states with it. At which point, the auto companies are back to where they were at the beginning of all this with a multiple Hydra-headed cafe fuel economy system, which they absolutely don't want, not at all. There's no way they want that. So, I think it's going to be interesting to see how the industry, California, and the Trump administration square this triangle. There's one final point.
Yeah.
It is not... And again, maybe I'm wrong. I don't think it's it's not good for the reputations globally of GM, Ford, or Fiat Chrysler to sign on to a retrograde, seemingly backward marching fuel economy climate standard here in the United States. Because guess what? Everyone else will find out.
Yeah.
Right? And Chinese will find out. And they'll say, what's the matter with you guys?
And you're driving armor-plated vehicles because they're safer.
So I don't know if that's a smart move. I think they know that's not a smart move.
I think they do. And then the other element, too, is we still have uncertainty. And what the automakers need more than anything else is just a certainty of what it is that they need to meet.
They do. But here's the issue, as I see it. Everyone's talking about rolling back the standards. Remember, the standards will still go up every year until 2021. Right. And what essentially Trump is saying is we stop it right there. We don't go all the way to 2025. And the other issue that's happening or is going to happen is this EV mandate, especially in California, that the other states are adopting. So now we have, by 2022, roughly 120-plus battery electric models hitting the market around the same time. I'm pretty confident. Let's see if the market proves me wrong. There's just not going to be enough buyers for those things.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of those vehicles that have very, 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 very small slivers of the market.
Right, right. Yeah. And so for the industry, what's going to happen? They're going to try to incentivize these things to sell them because they need the credits, which means prices are going to crash. It's going to destroy the resale value of these things. It's going to be a disaster. It's going to be a business disaster for the industry and for those electric cars, which are going to be essentially... I'm not going to say worthless, but they're going to be worth a lot less than internal combustion engine cars.
Because the variable that we're trying to control is a consumer, and the consumer is not going to be controlled. Now, part of it might be having to go through that process to get consumers to be more willing to consider EVs. Again, you talk to a bunch of people who haven't been
test drives
in the
at auto shows.
Test drives at auto
shows.
Well,
no kidding.
Right?
I mean,
electric
not?
Vehicles are not, most people have not really had any experience with them.
Right.
And
look at hybrids. Hybrids, there's no range anxiety. You don't have to worry about a charging infrastructure. And they're 2% of the market.
Mm-hmm. Consumers are not on board with the alternative fuel vehicles right now.
I think the industry, if you talk to them about a cafe standpoint, corporate average fuel economy, gasoline, they'll say, just leave the regulations where they are.
Yep.
Or maybe push it back to 2030. But when it comes to the EV mandate, everybody in this industry is starting to get really nervous.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And so the question is whether they're all betting, as far as I can tell, I'm talking to different companies about this, they're all betting, one, that the next generation of batteries that's going to be available to them in roughly 2020, 2021, depends on who you talk to, but it's something like that. There's kind of a belief that those batteries will be more capable, less expensive, longer range. And so there's a bet on that. I think there's a bet that there will be public support in terms of tax breaks and whatnot. And that related to that, there will be public support for infrastructure that actually, charging infrastructure that's actually, sufficient. And so the luxury car companies also seem to have bought in, to the idea that Elon Musk is right, that a battery electric car is a premium good, and people who can afford that really want that. I mean, that's like an emotional thing for them. But I agree. I mean, I look at Tesla, and I think I just can't wait until 2022 or 2021 when Audi, Mercedes,
Porsche,
Jaguar, on and on, all these premium brands are all going to have vehicles in the market, multiple models. They all swear up and down that they've gotten the message, no more science projects. These vehicles are going to look like premium vehicles. And I really can't wait to see what the luxury market looks like when that happens. Because, you know, Tesla has a 98% market share of premium electric vehicles now, right? Or whatever. I'm not even sure if it's 100%. When there's 40 German luxury and European luxury brands, and Cadillac probably too.
And Cadillac.
Know, Lincoln, whoever. When there's 40 or 50 premium electric vehicles, what's the market look like then? Do you think Tesla has a 98% share of a market that's 100 times bigger? I don't know.
No,
it will not. No. And, by the way, that's about the time that Tesla has completely run out of its $7,500 federal tax credits, and everybody else still has theirs.
And at that point, I mean, based on what they're saying now, we've got Model 3 and then Model Y coming, but no real major changes to S or X.
So, they'll be selling semi-trucks. They don't need to worry about
right. cars. Well, you just keep moving forward to the next thing. But, it's going to be an interesting thing then. Is I think that Tesla's success has not been that luxury buyers want EVs. It's they tapped into certainly a technology buyer who's very interested in.
Totally agree with
but
that.
But you can't necessarily extrapolate that to if Tesla could make, 100,000 more of their cars, everybody wants them. I think that's a very big leap.
Yeah. Hey, look, we're coming to the end of the show here. We've got lots of questions from the audience. We're not going to have time to get to them all, but somebody did take the time to make a phone call, and let's bring that in now.
Hi, Jim and Gary and guests. Jim, I got to tell you, I'm 67 years old, was a NASCAR fan for 50 years, and I mean loyal. But I'll tell you what, these stupid rule changes have ruined it for me, and I will never watch another race again. They run for so many laps and then take a break and reposition and give somebody a break and run so many laps and the rule changes have destroyed the racing, and I know this is why viewership has fallen off. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, we don't have Chrysler anymore. It's Toyota, Chevy, Ford. That's it. So thanks for allowing me to leave you a comment today. Wonderful show as always, and take care.
Real good. Thanks for that feedback. And like you, I feel the same way. I've been a NASCAR fan a long time. I'm just not that interested in
it. But what NASCAR tried to do was to address the whole issue of, gee whiz, they're going around in circles for, 4 hours. So what we'll do is we'll break the race up and we'll have more restarts. And so there'll be more action. So people will be more interested. But perhaps one effect of that is that basically that people are saying, we'll just wait till the race comes to an end and just watch it then.
Yeah.
Well, and from what we were talking about in the green room and some of the drivers not being on board with all of this. If the drivers are bored, then they're not going to be delivering the best products.
Plus, Earnhardt Jr. is retired.
I like what you said way back earlier in the show, Joe. Get real cars, put a roll cage in it, put a whiskey barrel in the back.
Have at it.
Go old school.
And let them go at it. Yeah.
Go old school. Right.
People should be chased by revenueers.
Yeah. Why not? Right.
Okay. So we've come full circle. Pretty much full circle. We're back at NASCAR at the end of the show. But with that, we are going to have to wrap it up. Stephanie Brinley, IHS Market, thank you so much for coming on the show. Great having you here.
It's a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Joe White, Reuters, great having you here, as always. And Gary, we'll be back at it again.
Next week.
And, of course, always have to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.